basic overview of the freedom of movement in international documents to give a perspective on the two case studies we'll be presenting. The right to free movement has been incorporated in many international documents throughout history. One of the first examples is actually in 1215 in the Magna Carta, which allows people to go out or into a kingdom freely. More modern example of that is in the UDHR in 1948, which recognized the right to free movement as one of the underlying rights of all humans. Since the UDHR, the right to free movement has been incorporated in at least 13 other international human rights documents. Most notably is the right to movement in the International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights, the ICCPR, which Article 12 delineates freedom of movement quite clearly, allowing people to leave and enter different states and territories freely. And it also notes that the right to free movement should not be subject to any restrictions, except for those that are provided by the law. And General Comment 27 to the ICCPR goes a little bit further. It was published in 1999 and addresses free movement, saying that the right to free movement is actually an indispensable condition for the free development of all people, and it is integral to the realization of other rights. So it's important to note that freedom of movement is both a basic human right and is also an essential human right in order to realize the other human rights that are protected by the international community. There are some cases where the right to free movement is restricted a little bit, and most particular to our context is in public health, which I'll talk about a little bit more. But in order for movement to be lawfully restricted, this restriction has to serve a permissible purpose. It has to be necessary to protect other rights, and that necessity has to be extreme. And importantly, it also must conform to the principle of proportionality, meaning that it must be the least intrusive instrument to protect other rights, and it can't arbitrarily deny people of rights for reasons that don't fall within this law. So like I was saying, the guideline for restricting movement is particularly important for public health. Public health officials do have the power to restrict movement, notably for isolation and quarantine. And here I have listed just two state laws from North Carolina that restrict movement under situations of isolation and quarantine so that communicable diseases are not passed among the community.
When we were looking at this relationship between freedom of movement and health, we focused in particular on how freedom of movement affects other rights that are related to health. States and non-state actors can create social and political policies which either force or restrict movement. So here are some examples, we tried to hit the main ones, of both forced and restricted movement. With forced movement, you can have the creation of social conditions that force people to become refugees, deportation, forced resettlement and collectivization, and refoulement, which is return of refugees to their country of origin. There's also restricted movement, which can take the form of physical barriers, such as walls, checkpoints, temporal barriers, which can also be checkpoints or curfews, bureaucratic barriers, such as registration permits, and incarceration. We try to just focus on a little one case kind of to give an idea of these links between freedom of movement and health. So here we focus on deportation. You can look at things that affect health before, during, and after deportation. So you have the threat or reality of physical violence or torture, inability to access social services such as health care, education, and social security. Denial of economic rights, such as the right to work or the right to own property, denial of civil and political rights, such as voting, and discrimination from the local population. During deportation, you'll have a separate set of kind of factors that are added in, perhaps an added risk of exposure, starvation, obviously separation from home and family, which causes severe mental health issues, and increased susceptibility to infectious disease. After deportation, you kind of have the sum of both of those kind of factors, and then factors in the new home, such as the discrimination from the new local population. I think I went over a lot of these already, but I wanted to stress mental health because I don't think it's touched on a lot. I think now it seems like there's more looking at mental health of refugees, for example. But worry and frustration about economic losses for families, separation from home and family and communities can have such a strong effect on health. Our first case study is of movement restrictions in the Soviet Union. They mainly took the form of deportation, forced collectivization, incarceration, and bureaucratic controls. Deportation was commonplace throughout the history of the Soviet Union. In 1944, for example, 8 ethnic groups were deported from within Russia to Central Asia. This included Chechens, the Volga Germans, Musquitian Turks. If you look at Musquitian Turks, for example, 15 to 17,000 died in transit. Following deportation, they had higher risk of malnutrition, typhus, and other poverty-related illnesses, insufficient food, shelter, clothing, and medical care, discrimination from the local populations where they were in Central Asia. And they weren't allowed to decide where they would live or where they would work, and they were deprived of all civic and political rights. Collectivization into both community and state-owned farms. This movement began in 1926, and it was supposedly voluntary. When not enough people were willing to move to the collective farms, people were forced to move there, hence the name neo-serfdom. An internal passport system kept people from being able to move, and until 1969, people who were born on the collective farms were not allowed to leave unless they were granted special permission, which is probably not very likely. There's research now that shows that the lowered agricultural production from these had a direct effect on the famines. For example, the Holodomor in the Ukraine in 1923, which estimates of mortality from that famine are between 2 million, which is the kind of official number, and 10 million. Of course, incarceration is a form of restriction of movement. It's thought that between 18 and 20 million people were imprisoned in the Soviet Union at various times. There was, of course, the physical effect of torture, forced labor. Former prisoners were often not allowed to move within 100 kilometers of cities, and to this day there exist many cities about, or kind of these villages, about 100 kilometers or 101 kilometers away from any city. Former prisoners and their families were often denied many different kinds of rights. And finally, bureaucratic control in both internal and external movement. So there was restriction of immigration and travel abroad via exit visas, which still exists in many of the former Soviet republics. The refuseniks, who were Soviet Jews in the 1970s who applied to move abroad and were not allowed to do so. Restrictions within the Soviet Union include the 1980 Summer Olympics in Moscow, where political prisoners, the homeless, and prostitutes were moved outside of the city, and the residence permit system, which I'll go into in a little more detail. So the propiska system was started as was a way to tie people to their land. It started under Peter I, actually, in Russia, and then was brought back by Stalin. It was abolished in 1991, but still exists in some form in many of the Soviet successor states. So we don't really have any kind of, we don't have anything like this here, but it's a permit that allows you to live in a certain city and often in a certain apartment or home. Without a propiska, it's difficult to find work. It's often difficult to possess or register property, to secure voting rights, the freedom to travel. Without it, it's difficult to register births, deaths, and marriages, which also has bearing on property, and access to education, social benefits, and probably most applicable here, medical care.
Now to move into the present, I'll be talking about movement restrictions in Palestine, and I'll be specifically focusing on four major methods of movement restriction, which is closure, curfew, checkpoints, and the building of the wall. So first, to talk about closure. Following the Six-Day War in 1967, Palestine was considered a closed military area by the Israeli government. And so the volatile situation there in 1972 led the Israeli Defense Force to issue general exit orders for occupied Palestine. So this basically means that Palestinians living in Palestine were able to move relatively freely between the West Bank, Gaza, East Jerusalem, and Israel, except for the hours of 1 a.m. and 5 a.m. when they were not allowed to enter or be in East Jerusalem or Israel. In June of 1989, ID cards were required, complicating the system a little bit more. So the IDs were relatively easy to obtain, except for people who had been released from prison, those who had been administrative detainees, and maybe most notably, those who had been detained and released without charge. Then in January of 1991, as a result mainly of the first Gulf War and worries that the situation would become more volatile, personal exit permits were required for all citizens of Palestine. And then in March of 1993, 9 Israeli civilians were killed and 6 members of the IDF were also killed. And this created a system of complete closure enforced. And the closure is highly dependent on the socio-political situation of the time period. And so during times of Jewish holidays and other times of the year when it's feared that violence might increase, closure becomes a pretty common occurrence. So just to talk about closure a little bit more, these charts show comprehensive closure days in 2005 and the first half of 2006 for the West Bank. And during comprehensive closure, all permits that have been issued by the Israeli government to Palestinians for work, trade, and healthcare are considered completely invalid. And so if you just look at 2005, the total number of closure days was 132, which represents 36% of 2005 were under comprehensive closure, meaning Palestinians were unable, like I said, to leave Palestine for any of the reasons that permits were granted for. The second type of restricted movement in Palestine is the use of curfew. Curfew has been used as a means of restricting movement pretty frequently. These two examples at the top are pretty notable. During Operation Defensive Shield, which is the term used by the IDF in 2002, a 24-hour curfew was imposed on a large percentage of the West Bank and continued all through that time period and then 2 to 3 weeks past May 3rd of 2002. So basically the second half of March, all of April, and all of May, a large percentage of Palestinians living in the West Bank were under 24-hour curfew. Then again, in June and August of 2002, during what was coined as Operation Determined Path, 24-hour curfew was imposed on all citizens in the West Bank except in the city of Jericho. And that means that over 2 million Palestinians were under constant curfew for almost 2 months. These curfews are often enforced using firearms, and it's often unclear to Palestinians living in the West Bank that, or whatever areas that is under curfew, what the regulations are. And again, this follows a socio-political climate. So during Passover of 2007, for example, Palestinians living in the West Bank were under 24-hour curfew for 2 weeks. And I just want to call it again into focus the idea of principle of proportionality that I mentioned earlier. Subjecting 2 million Palestinians to 24-hour curfew does not seem to follow the principle of proportionality. Checkpoints are often used in Palestine. The system of checkpoints was started by the IDF beginning in 1991. And so all Palestinians who are going through these checkpoints are required to show both ID cards and undergo physical searches and also property searches. And also in some areas, men between the ages of 18 and 35 are completely prohibited from passing through certain checkpoints. And often the checkpoints, as you can see, there's long lines. And it doesn't just take a couple minutes to go through. Sometimes it can take up to a few hours to get through. Some of the checkpoints are, the manned checkpoints are closed at certain times, open at others, and again, when these checkpoints are open is often not transparent. The first graph shows the number of checkpoints since disengagement in July of 2005. Initially, the number of checkpoints and roadblocks fell, but as of July of 2007, the number of checkpoints and physical roadblocks was up to 539, which is an increase of 43% since disengagement. And then on the other side, there are just a list of the types of physical barriers to movement that are in Palestine, including checkpoints that which can be both manned and unmanned, roadblocks, etc. I also wanted to mention the construction of the wall. The wall began to be built in 2002, and it was justified by the Israeli government with the purpose of, quote, saving the lives of Israeli citizens who continue to be targeted by the terrorist campaign that began in 2000. However, the International Court of Justice in July of 2004 deemed that the building of the wall was contrary to international law. However, the wall continues to be built. As of today, there's about 408 kilometers of the proposed 721-kilometer route that has been completed, which is over 50%, and a further 10% is still under active construction. And also of note is that the length of barrier on the green line is only 20%, and the rest of the barrier is completely off of the green line. So there has been some discussion about the effects of health on Palestinian population. This is just a statement by John Dugard, who is a special rapporteur for the UN on the rights of Palestinians living in occupied Palestine. And just to highlight some of the statistics, over 50% of the population in Palestine is unemployed. In one district in the West Bank, unemployment was 18% in 2000, and as of 2003, only three years later, unemployment had risen to 78%. Palestinians are largely reliant on food aid as a direct result of being isolated from their lands and being unable to move throughout Palestine. And 22% of children under the age of 5 are suffering from acute or chronic malnutrition. The World Bank also issued a statement in 2007 that restriction on Palestinian movement is the principal cause of economic decline of the Palestinian economy, which is a pretty strong statement saying that despite economic embargoes, despite a hostile political environment, in fact, restriction on movement is the number one cause of the economic decline of the Palestinian economy. The per capita GDP in the West Bank was a little over $1,600 in 1999. As of 2006, it had fallen over $500 to about $1,100 per person. And if we look at economic situation as an indicator for overall health, we can see just by those numbers that there's probably some concern about the restrictions on movement and health. But there are other concerns to highlight as well. And mental health concerns, as Kristen said, are very important and should not be ignored among the community. There's difficulty accessing land and water resources, especially as a direct result of the building of the wall. A lot of the water resources, the natural water resources in the West Bank, are completely cut off now by the building of the wall. And physical health is also of major concern. You can see here that 55% of clinics in the West Bank in particular have difficulty procuring drugs and medical equipment. 80,000 Palestinians have difficulty accessing emergency care. There have been many stories about emergency vehicles being unable to reach hospitals or emergency care facilities, and so people have been forced to wait at checkpoints to get access to this emergency health care, which during an emergency, waiting a few hours to get through a checkpoint is definitely the time between life and death. Malnutrition has increased, chronic disease has increased. The number of houses with safe drinking water has decreased by 8% since 2000. And so the health situation in Palestine is deteriorating, and that is in large part due on the restrictions of health. So Israel has an obligation to protect Palestinians living in Palestine through international documents. Israel became a signatory to the ICCPR in 1966 and ratified it in 1991, and they have no reservations or declarations to Article 12, which outlines the freedom of movement. It also has a special obligation under the Fourth Geneva Convention. Of course, Israel has the right and actually the obligation to protect its own citizens from terror or any other violence. But at the same point, it does have a special obligation under the Fourth Geneva Convention to protect the occupied. Israel is the occupying force and thus must abide by the Fourth Geneva Convention. And like I said before, current policies on movement are not satisfying the principle of proportionality. So when you have 2 million Palestinians under 24-hour curfew for a significant period of time, it's difficult to assess that as being proportionate to the to a threat of terror. And so just as a recommendation based on this case study, since it is a current day situation, we're calling on Israel to eliminate checkpoints, eliminate their comprehensive closures, eliminate curfews, halt the creation of the wall, and destroy all built portions of the wall, especially those that are not along the Green Line. And by supporting these stipulations that are in agreement with the UDHR and the ICCPR, Israel will be able to reaffirm its position in the world as a leader and set an example for upholding human rights, especially in the context of occupation. Here we just have a couple of websites if anyone is interested in learning more about freedom of movement or becoming involved. And references. And thanks to all these people.
We have a few minutes for questions and answers. So we had two case studies, one more historical and one contemporary case study on the freedom of movement. Any questions?
I think that there is a major difference between restricting movement between Palestine and Israel. So restricting movement between the two different areas is one thing. Of course, we'd all like to see everyone happy and peaceful together, able to move in between the two areas with no problem. But if Israel is looking to restrict movement between Palestine and Israel, that's one thing. But to restrict movement within Palestine is a different issue. So when people are unable to access their family members, unable to access jobs within Palestine, unable to access health care within Palestine, that presents a very big issue. And so I think that Israel does have the obligation to protect its citizens, and it should, but it should not infringe on the right of movement, especially within and between Palestinian villages. Well, I think that the idea of the IDF withdrawing from Gaza is an interesting one. I think that it's difficult to say that they've withdrawn from Gaza when they are now, for example, denying electricity and fuel to Gaza. So while they might not be at your doorstep if you have the inability to access electricity and other means that you need to survive, how can you say that you've withdrawn? So I think that the issues are very different between what's going on in the West Bank and Gaza in some regards, but in some areas it's also very similar. And I think also of note is that people can't pass between the West Bank and Gaza. So they really have made the two areas of Palestine into separate entities, which is posing problems in and of itself.
Yes.